ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। रीडिंग फ्रॉम कैंटो 10 चैप्टर 1 द एडवेंट ऑफ लॉर्ड कृष्णा इंट्रोडक्शन दिस इज टेक्स्ट नंबर 43। ज्योतिर्यथैव दोका पार्थिवेषु अधः समीर वेगानुगतं विभाव्यते एवं स्वमाया रचितेषु असौ पुमान् गुणेषु रागानुगतो विमूयति। Translation and a long purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. So please be attentive. It's a very philosophical purport by His Divine Grace. When the luminaries in the sky, such as the moon, the sun, and the stars, are reflected in liquids like oil or water, they appear to be of different shapes, sometimes round, sometimes long, and so on, because of the movements of the wind. Similarly, when the living entity, the soul, is absorbed in materialistic thoughts, he accepts various manifestations as his own identity because of ignorance. In other words, one is bewildered by mental concoctions because of agitation from the modes of material nature. Purport. This verse gives a very good example by which to understand the different positions of the eternal spiritual soul in the material world and how the soul takes on different bodies. Dihantara praptihi. The moon is stationary and is one. But when it is reflected in water or oil, it appears to take different shapes because of the movements of the wind. Similarly, the soul is the eternal servant of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But when put into the material modes of nature, it takes different bodies, sometimes as a demigod, sometimes as a man, a dog, a tree, and so on. But the influence of Maya, the illusory potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the living entity thinks that he is this person, that person, American, Indian, cat, dog, tree, or whatever. This is called Maya. When one is freed from this bewilderment and understands that the soul does not belong to any shape of this material world, one is situated on the spiritual platform, Brahma-Bhuta. This realization is sometimes explained as nirakar or formlessness. This formlessness, however, does not mean that the soul has no form. The soul has form, but the external agitating form he has acquired because of material contamination is false. Similarly, God is also described as nirakar, which means that God has no material form, but is Sachitananda Vigraha. The living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Sachitananda Vigraha, but his material forms are temporary or illusory. Both the living entity and the Supreme Lord have original spiritual forms, Sachitananda Vigraha. But the Lord, the Supreme, does not change his form. The Lord appears as he is, whereas the living entity appears because material nature forces him to accept different forms. When the living entity receives these different forms, he identifies with them and not with his original spiritual form. As soon as the living entity returns to his original spiritual form and understanding, he immediately surrenders to the Supreme Form, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This explains the Bhagavad Gita 7.19. Bahunam janmanamante jnanavan mam prapadyante. When the living entity, after many, many births in different forms, returns to his original form of Krishna consciousness, he immediately surrenders unto the supreme, unto the lotus feet of the supreme form, Krishna. This is liberation. As the Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita 18.54, Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma Nasochati Nakangshati Samaha Sarveshu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. When one is thus transcendentally situated, at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments nor desires to have anything. He is equally disposed to every living entity. In that state, he attains pure devotional service unto me. Surrender unto the Supreme Form is a result of bhakti. This bhakti, or understanding of one's own position, is the complete liberation. As long as one is under an impersonal understanding of the absolute truth, he is not in pure knowledge, but must still struggle for pure knowledge. Klesho adhiktaraste sham avikta asakta chetasam. Bhagavad Gita 12.5. Although one may be spiritually advanced, if one is attached to the impersonal form of the absolute truth, one must still work very hard, as indicated by the words klesho adhiktaras, which mean greater suffering. A devotee, however, easily attains his original position as a spiritual form and understands the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his original form. Krishna himself explains the forms of the living entities in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he clearly says to Arjun that he, Arjun, and all other living entities who are previously in their original forms are separate individual identities. They are individuals in the past. They are now situated in individuality. And in the future, they will all continue to maintain their individual forms. The only difference is that the conditional living entity appears in various material forms, whereas Krishna appears in his original spiritual form. Unfortunately, those who are not advanced in spiritual knowledge think that Krishna is like one of them and that his form is like their material forms. Avajananti ma mudha manushim tanum ashritam. Srimad Bhagavad Gita 9.11. Krishna is never puffed up by material knowledge and is therefore called achyuta. Whereas the living entities fall down and are agitated by material nature. This is the difference between the Supreme Lord, the living entity. In this connection, it must be noted that Vasudev, who is situated in a transcendental position, advised Kamsa not to commit further sinful activities. Kamsa is a representative of the demons, was always ready to kill Krishna or God, whereas Vasudev represents a transcendentally situated person to whom Krishna is born. Vasudev is a son of Vasudev. Vasudev wanted his brother-in-law Kamsa to refrain from a sinful act of killing his sister, since the result of being agitated by material nature would be that Kamsa would have to accept a body in which to suffer again and again. Yes, in the Srimad Bhagavatam 5.5.4, Rishabde also says, Na sadhu manye yata atmano yam asanapi kleshada ashadeha. As long as the living entity is entangled in the fruitive activities of so-called happiness and distress, he will receive a particular type of body and needs to endure the different kinds of suffering due to material nature. Tritapa yantrana. An intelligent person, therefore, must free himself from the influence of the three modes of material nature and revive his original spiritual body by engaging in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. As long as one is materially attached, one must accept the process of birth, death, old age, and disease. It is therefore advised that an intelligent person, instead of being entangled in so-called good and bad fruitive activities, should engage his life and advancing in Krishna consciousness. So that instead of accepting another material body, tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti, he will return home, back to Godhead. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada is very merciful here, reminding us of our basics. What we are hearing from Prabhupada is something which we have heard many times before. This is Prabhupada's kindness, that he keeps on reminding us the basic teachings as well, even though he may be catering to the purports of the 10th canto, where a prematurely or a immature devotee would probably want to hear something more rasika. But Prabhupada is a rasika devotee, but he knows that his audience is not rasika. His audience is a fallen audience of Kali, who are victims of the age, and to prematurely address topics which are beyond their adhikar would be not only irrelevant, but actually even damaging to the sadhaka. So, even in the 10th canto, Prabhupada is so kindly, elaborately bring back to our basics. This used to happen sometimes in our medical college, where there would be a viva, and we read all the latest advances in, you know, medicine and this and that, and the examiner asks you some very basic question. It's a very basic question. You're not focused on the basics very well, so you know all the hi-fi stuff, but you really don't know your basic stuff very well. So you sometimes just fail because you don't know your basics. And it's such a shameful thing. You do not understand your basics well, and you're talking about all this recent advances in this and that. So similarly, we can also understand that even though we have spent a few years in Krishna consciousness, we are still hovering on a platform where this is so important to hear, even now. And even when we hear this purpose now, it still clears some of those, you know, it makes things more clearer, it makes things more crystallized. The mind becomes more and more purified. Yesterday, Sankirtan Prabhu gave us an understanding about the mind. It is one of the most important topics for devotees to speak about, is it not? Because this is the central point of yoga. And coming to think about it, what is the difference between the non-devotee class of people and those who are interested in spiritual life? One essential difference among the many, many differences is that those who are not spiritually inclined are trying to fight a war outside of them. They're struggling day and night to harness, to tame down, to exploit the things outside of them, the forces of nature, how to tame them to our advantage. The weather, the oil, the water, the sunlight, how to somehow tame it in such a way that it comes under our grasp. And when it comes under our grasp, then we can manipulate it, exploit it, and use it, consume it for our individual sense gratification. This is the only purpose of modern science and none other. It wasn't the original purpose of science, of course, but today it has come to be like that. That all technology, all science is only for this purpose, how to understand the subtle laws of nature through research and development, and how to go so microscopically refined in your understanding of material nature that you can somehow see that you can bring it under your control, whether it is medical science or technology, whatever else, it's all the same thing. And the result of that is that it boomerangs back upon the person who's doing it. Right? The more you try to exploit control, the more you get entangled and victimized by the same laws which you're trying to control, because they are actually the laws of God. Trying to control nature is like trying to control God. Can anyone control God? Ishvara Paramakrishna, he is a supreme controller. He controls everything. So trying to exploit and harness the laws of nature to our advantage is like trying to bend and twist and turn God himself. And obviously there is going to be a rebellion and a slap and a tight slap on the face of someone who is trying to do that. So because of this reason, every attempt of modern science is meeting with failure. Every attempt is meeting with failure. Because the moment you make some progress, the moment you make some advancement, right, the impact, and we can sort of understand this a little more technically or mathematically by looking at what we call as the benefit-impact ratio. Right? So something is made by science for what? For benefit. Obviously, they don't want to, some benefit is there. Even if it is, whatever they made, I mean a bomb, whatever, there's some benefit to making that bomb because it suits my needs by killing those guys on the other side of the, on the wall. So it's advantage. So it's some benefit is there. But everything which you make, even a mobile or television or video, then the impact is, there is a small gain, obviously, but the impact in terms of the disadvantages is very, very large. So the ratio is never more than one. It's never more than one. It's always 0.1, 0.01. It's always be less than one. While in the past, when they used science as well, they also did it for advantage, for improvement, for benefit, for enjoyment. But they were always conscious about the impact. And therefore, the ratio is always more than one. Right? So we can see that the mobile is so useful, but now they can use the same mobile in the hands of a terrorist, and we are all concerned that, you know, if you leave a mobile somewhere in the train, you know, everyone will run away from the dabba, you know, because there's a mobile maybe, you know, under the, you know, used by somebody else to be, you know, blow it off or whatever else. And so it's, you know, everything which is being done, how the SMS system is being used to, you know, people are using it for doing all sorts of crazy things, obscene things. So everything, that computer is there also, but so many people have destroyed their lives by going on the wrong sites, right? The small children, you know, very naive, even adults, very naive. So the benefit part is there, but the mind being so degraded always takes the negative side of the particular type of, you know, invention. And because it is corrupted, the mind is corrupted, therefore it always uses the negative side of a particular type of progress for destructive purposes. So the benefit-impact ratio is very, very small, very, very small. On the other hand, a spiritualist is a person who is not at all waging a war outside of him. His war is all internal. He's trying to harness, to control, to tame down what? His senses and his own mind. So there's a big, you know, difference about how the world views are. The man, the average man is trying to just do things outside. This, cars, air conditioners, you know, there's satellites, there's so many things outside. Because he's totally Bahir Mukha. His whole world is Bahir Mukha. So his kicker, he has just absolutely no understanding of the fact that there is a world within as well. He is just absolutely oblivious to the internal world. His whole world is the outside world, which he thinks is for his enjoyment. But for a devotee, or even for the matter of a spiritualist, his whole world, his karma kshetra, his field of activity, is his internal thing. So the moment you're going for a yatra, devotees, this is this typical thing, you go for a yatra, then devotees say, Prabhuji, you know, you have been to Vrindavan before, and what should be our consciousness in Vrindavan? Can you tell what should be our consciousness in that? So then you have to take a bath in the Jamuna, or, you know, and she said, Maharaj, can you tell us what should be our consciousness when you take bath in the Jamuna? You know, so, you know, or eating prasad, and said, how should we honor this prasad? And it's Mahaprasad. So how we just take it and put it in the mouth? No, but that's all right. But, you know, what should be our prayer, you know? What should be our consciousness? So this is what a devotee becomes. His absolute concern is not just the external act. He's absolutely concerned about the supreme reality, which is the only reality in this world is consciousness. Prabhupada is making so clear over here. Everything other than consciousness is superficial and false, ultimately. It's temporary reality only. Only reality is always consciousness. And therefore, our moment is simply based on that. Our moment is so beautifully labeled as, it's such a beautiful name. The acronym is so nice. It's the International Society for Krishna. Prabhupada would have probably said, International Society for Krishna. Krishna, consciousness. Huh? And each and every word is so relevant and so important. But today we are talking about here, what is being talked about is the word consciousness. It's so very important. So this is what the devotees or the yogis or the jnanis, for that matter, whatever, they're all trying to tame down the mind, which is the focus of all yogic processes, whether it is jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, karma yoga, raja yoga, any yoga you call it, but there is no question of progress other than harnessing the mind. So Prabhupada is giving the example, beautiful. This is something which is day-to-day example, which you all can even see it anytime you want to see it, right? You just have a drum of water, and a big wind comes. Huh? The globe is, a bulb is shining over the drum, right? And the wind comes, and how the water starts shaking. And you see the globe, you don't see the bulb anymore. You see, you see something like that, right? And so it's still, the bulb is there, the water is there, but there is no wind. It's just absolutely breezeless day. There's no wind at all. It's just like one of those days when there not even a single leaf moves, nothing moves, and you're just perspiring. You look at the same drum and see the water is absolutely still, and you can see the globe as it is. It's a perfect reflection of the bulb above, right? So this is what is being spoken over here. It's so nice. So what is making the change? The drum, the water is the same, the bulb is the same, everything is the same. What is creating the difference is the wind. A wind is the source of change, is the cause of change, right? And what is the wind in this case? You are the same, God is the same. But why am I able to understand that I am Brahman? Why? Because of the wind. What is the wind here? The agitations of the mind. Just like the wind is creating the agitations in the water, the modes are creating the agitation in the mind. So as long as the modes keep agitating the mind, which is like the water, you cannot really see yourself within that water. The moment the mind is still, then you see the globe, right? Similarly, you see yourself, right? So it's so simple and yet so profound that the process of yoga is ultimately to still the mind. So the mode of ignorance is like a very, very agitated state. It's not even actually agitated, it's actually, it's like that. It's like the drum of water is filled with, you know, something like, something black. So there's no reflection practically. You know, it's not even agitated. It's still water. But it's, inside whatever something is put, someone has put some black, dirty stuff, some tar or something, whatever. Something dirty is there inside. Gutter water maybe, Gutter water. So there's a big bulb above, but the drum is not showing anything. Because it is a still water, but it is black. So there's no reflection practically. And on the other hand, the mode of passion is that there is some clarity in the water, definitely, but it's very, very shaky water. So still you're not able to see what is above. And what is mode of goodness? It is clear water. Clear water and not agitated water. It is clear and transparent, not agitated. It is peaceful. So we are all trying to make the mind peaceful. That's what we want to do. Only through a peaceful mind we can really reflect on the internal world within us. But as we know that the advantages of this is that, I mean, it's very, very beautiful that how wise are the people who are spiritualists. That they accept that the world outside cannot be controlled. I mean, they know it. They've understood, they realize it. So it's a futile attempt to do that. Right? But they try to work on the internal world. Why? Because the perception of the external world is through the mind. It's so beautiful, right? So no matter what the external world is like, there's a crisis, there's a storm, there's a death in the family, there's a burglary, there is a disaster, or there is great happiness, or whatever else. Whatever is happening in the outside world, it's all being processed through what? Through the mind. So you just take care of the processing instrument, the mind, then exactly you know how to perceive the things outside. But if you don't have a proper perceptive, your perceptive device itself is defective, then everything you see is going to be defective. Everything you understand is going to be defective, right? And so Maharaj was explaining in 1991, same class, that in the same chariot, Arjuna is sitting, Krishna is sitting, standing, and speaking. Same chariot, now Krishna's representative is standing. Who's there? Vasudeva is there. And so Arjuna, who's there? Kamsa. Same philosophy, practically the same. This is second chapter, right? Probably showed in second chapter, yeah. So this is second, the basics, our basics. Krishna's Gita summarized. So the same knowledge, a devotee and Krishna's duty are speaking the same thing, they're speaking the knowledge. But we can see the Kamsa's mind, Kamsa nothing is sticking inside, poor fellow. this is a beautiful philosophy, but nothing is sticking in his mind because his mind is all so agitated by the Akashvani that his mind becomes, you know, just a few minutes back, he was very peaceful, actually. Just driving his chariot and just going like that, and everything was very fine. Looking here and there, and it's a beautiful, nice day, and my sister is married, and Vasudeva, wow, very nice. Like a very, this is the custom. The brother carries the sister to our house because, she's new there and she doesn't know anybody else there, like a strange world for her. So somebody whom she knows, a brother is there, and it makes her comfortable and, sort of makes things more congenial for her. It makes her emotionally pacified. So he was in that mood. That was the initial intention, at least. But the moment that Akashvani came, immediately there was a change. This dramatic change. And his real nature just erupted out of his consciousness. Just erupted out of his consciousness. And from being a very loving brother, who's supposed to protect her, drive her home, this and that, he wanted to kill her. So what an absolute dramatic change of consciousness. And what a massive agitation of the mind, that he lost his complete sense of balance. How can you even just think of this, that you can draw your sword for killing your own sister? I mean, it's not even thinkable. Even in the modern world is quite degraded, but even then, even to us today, it still looks pretty horrible to think of this, right? On somebody on marriage day killing your own sister, it's still a horrible thing. It will be news if it happens. In the paper, I'm sure they'll find it sensational. It's not a usual thing which keeps happening every day. It's still a very horrifying thing. I want to talk about 5,000 years ago. This was a very terrible thing to happen on a Vedic sacrifice and this and that. Right? So the same knowledge is being spoken, but the instrument to understand this knowledge, the mind of Kamsa is so agitated. Right? And again, Maharaj makes the comparison that Arjuna is supposed to kill his own cousins, and here Kamsa is killing his own cousin's sister, right? So there's a further example, further parallel over there as well. And so in this way we can see that Kamsa is totally out of control. He's totally out of control. He just cannot understand this. At last, some deal is made and some sort of patchwork is made, and Kamsa gets somewhat pacified. That will come a little later. So, Maharaj goes to explain very elaborately about how this mind and the perception is, everything depends on how we perceive things. He was giving the example at the time that when we come to the Mangalarti, for example, in the morning, and devotees are very happy to greet the Lord, they sing song, and they play the drum, and then the moment this crescendo takes place, and they start dancing, they start jumping, and then twirling, and it's twisting, and raising their hands and little loud volume, and it's more ecstatic, and then boom, Jaya Vishnupad, right? So that goes to like that. But the same thing when it is perceived by our neighbors, For them, say, oh no, it's 5 o'clock, and that, oh, this guy has every day, you know. So in the morning, I remember old days, we used to have this big womper. Sometimes I used to play the big one. And imagine at 5 o'clock, it was really insensitive on our part, let's face it. Huh? But at Mangalarti, 5 o'clock, bam, bam, knee, thigh, gore, you know. And it's a huge decibels of sound, and the whole chapati hears that there's something going on here. The whole chapati. And of course, that was banned afterwards, and you come to the small ones, and then the real small ones. Ching, ching, ching. But the perception that for them it's a huge agitation of the mind. And for us, it's like everyone is blissfully dancing, jumping, and say, wow, it couldn't be better than this. Everyone is greeting Radha Krishna, enjoying, understanding the mood of the kirtan and all that. So same activity, but absolutely opposite responses. Opposite responses. So in this way, we can see that the activity, as they say, one man's food is another man's poison. It's so true. I mean, when Prabhupada was doing that yagya, and putting that ghee in that yagya, the first few days in ISKCON, and that was in 22nd Avenue, and that ghee was creating that, you know, aroma, and it was going to the neighbors' noses, and they were finding, "Shee, what's this? It's pure ghee," and they had never had the smell in their its aroma, but for them it was like horrifying smell. And Prabhupada was like, "This is very purifying to inhale." The same smoke, the same ghee, but to somebody who's, you know, has not even had any expert mode of goodness. No, ghee means you have to be in a mode of goodness to appreciate what ghee is, right? Otherwise, then it's all something else. So for them, it was like a big, big, big disturbance. And they told that, you know, what is this? Stop this. But for someone else, like when the fish is being cooked or some garlic is being cooked, you know, it's, wow, it's so pungent. Cannot stand it. But for people who are, you know, really tuned to that taste, wow, today mummy has made fish fry. Ah, very nice. So the same thing is one man's food, another man's it is poison. So nothing really actually is real. Is what really, what gives something value or no value is based on our own perception. Right? For devotees, chanting is so important. For people, it's such a waste of time. You guys, 2 hours, you're wasting your time. Do something productive. 2 hours are gone. For us, this is the most important part of our life. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. So everything is like that. Everything is based on perception. Right? So we can see that, you know, when the mind, I was reading this small, you know, there's a small notice there in Prabhupada that we can try and understand. Of course, we have spoken so many times about the perils of what uncontrolled mind is all about. But let's try and understand for a few minutes, you know, what happens to the mind when it is really controlled, really in a state of peace with itself and the surrounding, really steeped in Krishna consciousness. So the moment you add in that, just taking the example of water a little further, once you put that water, like you have a bleach, right, a bleaching agent, right, you however dirty the water is, you put a bleaching agent, it becomes immediately clear, right? So Krishna is like that bleaching agent. The moment, however the mind is, you know, and it's tainted with red or yellow or green or blue, whatever else the color of the water is, right? The moment you put a bleaching agent of Krishna, the whole water becomes transparent, right? So Krishna is like that. And it becomes very still. The mind becomes very still because Krishna is like a mountain. When Krishna enters your mind, it doesn't shake. Is it not? Krishna is so powerful. Krishna cannot be shaken. Krishna is unshakable. Maybe there's a name for Sanskrit in this, unshakable, something, I don't know. Yeah, achalam. Krishna is achalam. A mind is chanchala. Krishna achalam, right? So Krishna enters something, even he can hold a huge mountain, doesn't shake. He doesn't shake in holding it, and he's shaking, and the mountain is still, and he is still, and everything is still, nothing is happening, and, you know, upstairs, everything is, you know, going crazy. Andhra is getting crazy, getting mad. It's totally, you know, it's totally disturbed. But, you know, yeah, Krishna, everything is still here. A lot of wind outside, but inside, under the Gaudanil, everything is fine, everything is great, everything is pleasant, everything is beautiful, everything is very merrymaking and all that. Right? So once Krishna really enters the arena, anywhere, he just is a powerful stabilizer. That's why we have stabilizers for this electricity. Once you put that. So once your mind accepts Krishna, it becomes stable. So all the fluctuations in the current, which are taking place from the outside world, cut, 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 cut. The current is going up, down, there, down. So you get the fuse gets, you know, what do you call that? Fuse goes off. So the fuse is like that. It trips, cut. But the moment you have Krishna in your mind, no matter what happens outside, you just become so stable, the fuse doesn't just trip at all. You can face anything. Even if you have something like death, Srimad Bhagavatam starts with that huge agitation, a huge catastrophe, a huge type of, you know, crisis in a person who was a king of the world. From the man who was in absolute control of the entire planet. Not as king, you know, some Baroda ka king or some, you know, Nizam of Hyderabad and all that. He's a king of the entire planet. Now, that's a big thing. That's not a small time person. He's a very powerful man. He has everything on the planet under his control. The mountains, the waters, the diamonds, the rubies, the elephants. Everything belongs to him. From that state of supremacy and domain and control, imagine saying that in 7 days you're going to die. Wow. Even people like us, we have nothing practically. Not even an elephant or... We have nothing. We don't have a piece of land also. We have just a small house. And if even we were told that you're going to die in 7 days, it'll be a huge catastrophe. When we have nothing, we're like paupers in front of Parikshit Maharaj. But if we are told, our whole world will shake and become upside down. But because he had the stability of hearing from Shukadev Goswami, how stable was his mind? Not when Srimad Bhagavatam, well, 7 days, okay, now it's 3.5 days remaining, Okay, 3.5 days remaining. Yes, yeah. He's not thinking of that. He's now on the last day, or maybe the second last day now. He's not thinking about, oh, when is that bird going to come, the takshak, you know. He's not thinking of that. You don't find anywhere the slok where Parishmada is thinking, in the next 6 hours, the takshak is going to come. He's completely stable. He's so stable. He's so absorbed in the world, in its internal world of Krishna. And his heart is just rejoicing. Prasannatma. There's no sochati, there is no damn kankshati. There's no just desire of this world. Everything which belonged to him is not any more of any relevance, because again, it is all like the shaking of the mind. I am the controller, therefore I am supposed to control. It is all a part of the mind, ultimately. So realizing the fallacy and the futility of the superficial, you know, sort of control of being the king, he now understands that I am Krishna Das. I'm not the king of this world. I was never the king of this world. I ruled the ruled as a king when I was supposed to, but now maybe Krishna wants to do something else. That's all right with me. Somebody else will come. My son will come. Janmajaya will come and take over. No problem. Right? So things will go on. But he was stable. He was focused. Why? Because he had the Krishna factor. Anyone who has this Krishna factor is so stable in his mind. It's not a matter of just artificial positive thinking. They have this positive thing, positive. Think positive, Prabhu. Think positive. Not Prabhu, I mean, think. No, no. So think, I mean, there is, why should it be, how can people just think positive? It will not last too long. A small thing, and your positive will just go into tremendous negativity. What is the positive factor to think, which is the basis of positivity? What is? Krishna is the supreme positive. Right? So, no matter what really happens in devotee's life, whether it is Kunti Maharani or Bhishma or Parikshit Maharaj, and for the matter even our dear Soka Krishna Prabhu, whom we lost a few years ago, same thing. A man of 31 years, having cancer, all in a spine, become paraplegic, bedridden for 6 months, young wife, pregnant, carrying a baby, on his deathbed, And then he's smiling. Someone says, this man is crazy. How is he smiling at his deathbed? But no, it was prasannatma. His atma was prasanna. That's why he was smiling. But he has this Krishna factor with him. He had the guru factor with him. He had the devotee factor with him. When you have Krishna, when you have devotees, when you have the holy name, then nothing of this world can really disturb us. It may, to some extent, in the beginning, but the moment to really take shelter, when the problem really comes, like we all of us have Krishna, we all have Guru, we all have holy name, but we're not really taking shelter sometimes. But when that problem comes, it's a gain, it's a bonus. Why? Because at that time, you really, really take shelter. And then that thing acts upon our consciousness to the fullest extent, because you're really taking shelter, so it acts upon you. Yathamam parpadyante. The more you take shelter, the more it gives you shelter. The more you don't take shelter, the more it does not give you shelter. It's like that. So the moment you take shelter in your moment of crisis, you get complete protection from that, and then nothing of this world will disturb us. And therefore the devotee is victorious. Param vijayate. He's always victorious. is never defeated. A devotee is never defeated. You never find a Krishna's devotee ever defeated. Even in Jatayu's death, Jatayu is victorious. Because Ram did a samskar and Ram gave him his last rites. Right? I mean, which vulture will have God do his samskar? It's not possible for a vulture to get God do his samskar. It's not possible. It's completely, you know, foreign idea. But Param Vijayate, in dying for Ram, dying for Sita, he was victorious. So for a devotee, when in his apparent success or an apparent failure, he is always successful. Because he has a Krishna factor with him. Krishna is always going to give him success. He's never a failure, no matter what he does. Right? So this is our hope, this is our understanding, that we want to really have mere mana mandir mein ek bar aa jao giridhari. We always think like that. My dear Lord, just once enter my mind. Right? So once Krishna comes in, then he comes along with Giridhari and Govardhan is there, everything is there, the cows are there, and the whole spiritual world is there. I mean, you have the spiritual world in your heart. And what does it really matter of this flimsy thing outside and this matter, corroding matter, degrading matter? You can just see through it. It's okay. It's fine. My body is crumbling down. Everything is crumbling down. It doesn't really disturb you so much because you have the bliss of Krishna with you. It's like Govardhan. Govardhan was getting all agitated from up. You know, the thunderbolts, wind, storm, hailstorm, this, that, everything. But the Krishna factor was there. Krishna was touching him. And Govardhan was like absolutely relaxed. He was smiling. Ah, it's having a great time. Never was a day in my mind. Waiting for this day since, you know, Satyuga. When I will, you know, I was, Purasthamani brought me here and I stayed here just for this one day when Krishna will touch me. So he was so happy. So we become like that. With the one finger of Krishna touches us, then even Indra's hailstorm cannot disturb us. Right? This is the power of Krishna consciousness. This is the power of Kripa of the spiritual master. This is the power of the holy name. And we're hoping that we can really imbibe these beautiful teachings. Because that is the only way we can, you know, take care of the outside fluctuating material nature, going up and down, so many variations, fluctuations, but remain stable in Krishna consciousness. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare
Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu, for so nicely describing about the mind and the graphic example you gave of Kamsa about how he was so agitated, he was so peaceful one moment and suddenly he became so agitated, and then you were explaining how mind as you called it, as a perceiving instrument was defective. So I was thinking, after decades of practice of Krishna consciousness also, sometimes, in fact on many occasions, we may be like actually peaceful and doing devotional service nicely, and then some disturbing news comes or some provocative situation or some humiliation or things like that, and then, you know, you go... And then, does that mean that despite years of practicing sadhana bhakti, our perceiving instrument is defective? Is the process not working for us? How should we take it when, as sadhakas also, we struggle with, not exactly like Kamsa maybe, but something like that, you know? How do we understand this phenomenon?
I think it is... it's like an inverted ocean. It's like an inverted ocean. Like, you know, real ocean is like having a lot of waves on the top, but peace below. But you have an inverted ocean, you have peace outside and a lot of agitation below. Right? Yeah. Why I say this is because the mind is like an ocean. It is a source of desires, impressions from this life and past life. Right? So in our accepting Krishna consciousness, we have been able to tame down the superficial conscious part of our mind. The conscious mind at least has become, you know, we are not consciously hating somebody, you're not consciously trying to kill somebody, harass somebody, or, you know, politicize somebody, or, you know, stab somebody in the politics. You know, devotees don't do that. But they are not nice, they are nice people. Basically, they're nice people, right? Yeah, devotees are nice people, I believe that. They're really not really outgoing in trying to really tend to damage, tarnish somebody's good character, or, you know, defame him. They don't do that. So at least on an external platform, we have been able to come to us a level of sanity and decorum and some sort of a civilized behavior. We have become like that at least. We have become civilized. We have become humane in our approach. But the bottom part of our consciousness is a subconscious mind where all these other impressions and everything else is there. I mean, that's not really so much which we are really aware what's underneath. You know? So one thing, like a big strong pebble, boom, it falls in that. It's a big, a small pebble, maybe, you know, it'll tung, a little bit of ripples will be there and you will be able to, but it's a huge rock, fuck, it falls on this thing and immediately everything will start shaking. And then the water goes up and down and agitation starts. So it's like the bottom part has still to become a little more calm. A little more calm. Therefore, Maharaj made us say this statement years ago. The greatness of a man is known by how we can tolerate provoking situation. How we can, tolerate provoking situation. He made us repeat this three times. So that's the two true criteria for greatness. We may think that I am great because I am doing X activity, right? We all attach a sense of greatness to ourselves because of the things, the great things I am doing. Therefore, I must be great. Because look at these great things I am doing, you see? You know, you are not doing that, I am doing that, so I am great. But the real evaluation of greatness is not that, what you are doing externally. It's what is, again, an internal criteria. That when a provoking situation is there, someone provokes you by his, as he said, humiliating words or situations, and then how we react. So the stimulus is there to really react in a very horrible way, really tit-for-tat way or like that. But when the deeper part of our mind or the intelligence, for example, is more also fixed up in Krishna consciousness, right? The intelligence comes in control immediately and prevents the restless mind from really going nuts. Right? So, it's all a matter of, fortifying our intelligence. And once that is done, then the higher forces of intelligence will come into play, that even though the mind is in a susceptible or gullible to agitation, which will take a long time for the mind to get purified, right? Because like an ocean, how to get the whole damn, range of water from up to down cleared up and transparent, it'll take a long, long, long time. But at least we have the intelligence which is in force, which has been activated at least to some extent. Earlier before, this one is not even activated. It was like deactivated, non-existent stuff. Right? Or maybe it was there, but it was always sort of subservient to the mind. But now we have activated to go into the controlling mode, controlling the mind. So by hearing regular Srimad Bhagavatam, by reading our scriptures, we become more intellectually convinced of my rightful behavior. So even though the mind wants to hit back or wants to, say some slang words and really do something crazy, the intelligence will say, wow, you're a devotee, Prabhu. You're supposed to know better. You're supposed to behave a little better than this. Take care. Maybe you're treading wrong waters, right? So the intelligence comes into play and then of course you understand, Prabhu, I really blew my head over you. I'm sorry. Intelligence comes. And you really go into the other understanding that even though I have done something crazy, I did something wrong, then the devotional mind, the intelligence says that, okay, I can ask for forgiveness from the Lord, from the devotee, from whatever else, I can somehow rectify. Next.
I always feel this doubt is to be there in my mind. Continuing with Rajvihari Prabhu's question, we understand that whenever the problem comes, we have to subdue it out, and we know that this is the thing which we have done is wrong. But in our scriptures, we see some examples, like an example of Bhima, like an example of Lakshman. They are the devotees who are very, 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 whenever something comes up, they get so much agitated and they become so fired out. And
you,
although they were considered...
You asked this to Maharaj also, didn't you remember?
So, they are considered the pure devotees. And they are one of the, they are the most nearest devotee, and Krishna had very intimate relationship with them. in that circumstances, sometimes we feel it. I have the nature like Bhima.
Then you have to also eat like Bhima. to be having his nature.
So in that circumstance, what should we do? That should we try to improve or should we just take it for granted?
I remember your question clearly that this was asked to Maharaj. I've forgotten his answer. I would have repeated the same answer for you. But Maharaj did give a beautiful answer at the point of time when you asked this question. My understanding is very feeble on this subject. I can answer you by with one line from the Shastra that is said, which is said that Vaishnavara Kriya Mudra Vigyana Bhujaya. That's what I would say in one line to you. That we cannot understand or interpret the activities of the great souls. We don't have that adhikar, we don't have the potency, we don't have the purity to appreciate why Bhima is acting like this. Now, we are looking at Krishna in our own eyes and seeing that he is, you know, he makes so many mistakes in understanding Krishna because, you know, he does so many things which are apparently not fitting into the, you know, what you call normal moral codes and exactly like that. Similarly, when you're looking from your own perceptive device of your defective, impure mind, even we are looking at Bhima in a defective manner, even though he is perfect. Whatever a pure devotee does, he is always a stringed instrument in the hands of God. Raman Rai says that when he's saying so many things, oh, Krishna is making, Mahaprabhu, you are making me say all these things. Thakur Haridas is saying, you know, you are making me do all these things. Right? So the Prabhupada says the same thing, of course, that when you make. So a pure devotee, whatever he is doing, is actually just a stringed instrument in the hands of God. So if the person who's playing the instrument is like trying to bomb, 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 he wants to play it in a different way. So why is the instrument, you know, blowing up like this? Huh? But instrument is absolutely not doing his own thing. So Bhima may be blowing up or Lakshmana may be doing things like that. From our perception, it's maybe right, wrong, not so good, not so right, whatever. But the instrument, you know, what is Lakshmana? Lakshmana is just a shadow of Ram in one sense. He's just always with Ram. So, you know, how he moves, how he behaves, it's all something superior beyond us to understand. We cannot understand activity of the great souls. We cannot understand our own activities. We're talking about understanding Ram and Lakshman is God. Lakshman is God, you know. So we can't understand ourselves, we can't understand our wives, we can't understand our children, why they behave like this. We can just understand people who are just around us, right? Whom we're supposed to know better, right? We're supposed to know our wives better, we're supposed to know our children better. Why? You know, Lakshman is such a far off person. We don't know how he behaves, but why? We don't know. We just don't know. And we don't even want to try to know. Let him behave the way he wants. He's independent personality, you have got it. I would like to know how I am behaving. Am I doing the right thing? Am I behaving the right way as I'm supposed to do? So let us analyze not Lakshman or Bhima, let us analyze ourselves. Let us be more inclined towards knowing what I am doing, why, how I am thinking, how I am speaking, how I am behaving. Let me look at critically at my own self, Atma Nirikshana. Right? Like in a microscope at Lakshman, you can't see anything. Look at a microscope with your own heart. Sorry, Prabhu. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagavan ki jai, Gaur Premanandi.